For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. March 30th, this is a shiur entitled Neutering and Spaying an Animal, the Critical Precedent of the Sale of Chametz. The question of neutering and spaying an animal or pet and the critical precedent of the sale of chametz. So if you've seen the Gemara, then you have seen that there is a discussion already in the Gemara about having an animal neutered. It was common practice to want to have this done if you were a farmer, because an animal that has been neutered is better for plowing a field, for threshing, whatever it is you needed animals to do, and it was better to have it neutered. And so it was an issue already in the time of the Gemara of is there a way that we can do this or not? There is a prohibition in the Torah against doing such a thing, and we're not allowed to do it to animals, and therefore it already comes up. Now, to review the Gemara quickly, the Gemara wants to know that we know that you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something on Shabbos that we cannot do. So we're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. We can't ask a non-Jew to light a fire for us. We're not allowed to carry something outside of an Eruv on Shabbos. We're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to carry something for us out of an Eruv on Shabbos. We're not allowed to do that. That we know. That's 100% known by everybody that we can't do that. And it's not undisputed. The Gemara wants to know, that prohibition against asking a non-Jew to do what we can't do, is that limited only to Shabbos? Or is that true of all prohibitions? The Gemara's discussion here is about muzzling an animal when it's threshing, which we can't do. Lo sachsom shor b'disho, you're not allowed to muzzle an animal when it's threshing. So we know we can't do it. And can we ask a non-Jew to do it for us? Another example would be, what about cooking milk and meat? You're not only not allowed to eat milk and meat, you're not allowed to cook milk and meat together. Can I ask a non-Jew to cook milk and meat for me? Could I do that? I can't do it, he can. So could I ask him to do it for me? It would be the same question as this Gemara, which is that if I can't do something, can I ask a non-Jew to do it for me? Now the question of the Gemara is only a question with those prohibitions that I can't do, but he can do, like Shabbos, or like muzzling an animal in its threshing, or like cooking milk and meat. But obviously, I can't ask a non-Jew to commit a murder, and I can't ask a non-Jew to steal, because... what's the reason? Because he's not allowed to either. So I can't ask him to do what he can't do. I can only ask him possibly to do what I can't do, but he could do. But something which he can't do either, I can't ask him to do. Now, why not? Why could I not ask him to do what he can't do? I'm not doing it, he's doing it.
You're putting a stumbling block in front of
him. Okay, because I'm putting a stumbling block in front of someone else who is not allowed to do something. We have a mitzvah in the Torah, v'lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol, do not put a stumbling block in front of a blind man, which means that you're not allowed to enable someone to do what they can't do. That's true of Jews and non-Jews. So you can't give, the classic example in the Gemara is if there is a Nazir is not allowed to drink wine. I could drink wine, but I'm not allowed to hand a glass of wine to a Nazir because he can't do it, and I'm not allowed to enable him to do what he can't do. So if a non-Jew is not allowed to steal, I can't ask him to steal. If he's not allowed to murder, I can't ask him to murder because I can't ask him to do what he can't do. Forget whether I can do it or not, but I can't ask him to do what he can't do. So the question of the Gemara about whether I can ask him to muzzle the animal when it's threshing, or my example of cooking milk and meat, the only reason why we have that question is because those are cases which he could do if he wanted to. The question is, could I ask him to do what I can't do? That's the question of the Gemara. So the Gemara wants to prove this question with the case of neutering an animal. And the Gemara cites a case where it was a regular thing that used to happen, that Jews would allow their non-Jewish acquaintances to quote-unquote steal their animal, neuter it, and then somehow the Jew would get it back. What they would do is they would leave the animal out in the field unprotected, without a leash or anything, and they would make it clear to their non-Jewish friends that, you know, there's an animal sitting in the backyard. It would be nice if it was neutered. And the non-Jew would steal it, take care of it, and then somehow it would be found and the Jew would get it back, and then the Jew would offer some sort of a gift to the non-Jew to pay him for his services. This is what would happen. So the Gemara says that if a Jew does that, then we penalize him because he tried to act in a tricky manner. He did what he's not allowed to do. A Jew is not allowed to have a non-Jew neuter the animal for him, and he did, and therefore he's going to have to sell the animal. He's not allowed to keep the animal and derive benefit from it. He has to get rid of the animal. So the Gemara is very clear. It is prohibited to have a non-Jew neuter an animal for you. You can't do that. So the Gemara wants to prove from here that you see that you can't ask a non-Jew to do what you can't do. I can't have him do what I cannot do myself. That's what the Gemara wants to prove in this case. The Gemara then says back, not necessarily. You don't see that from this case. Because it's unclear whether neutering an animal is permitted for a non-Jew or prohibited. We know there are 7 Noachide laws. Mitzvot B'nei Noach, there are 7. Now, I asked the group I was with to name the 7, and they had a little bit of trouble. So, let's name the 7 so we know what they are. There are 7 that most everyone agrees to are the 7. Thank you very much. There are 7 Noachide laws. We know there are 7. And they are, I think the ones that we know of, don't murder, don't steal. Then there's Gilui Arayos, which includes adultery and some forms of incest. 3. Then we have idolatry, or to worship other gods, that's prohibited as well. We have a requirement upon non-Jews also to have a court system of some sort. That's 5. We have cursing God. Okay, and eating a limb that was taken from a live animal. Even if that animal is now dead, but it was taken from a live animal, not allowed to eat from that limb. Those are the 7 that most authorities agree to are the 7 laws. However, there is an opinion that says that one of the 7 is don't neuter an animal. The non-Jews are just as prohibited from doing it as we are. Can't do it. So the Gemara says, therefore, the fact that a Jew is not allowed to have a non-Jew neuter an animal for him, and if he does, we punish the Jew, we make him sell the animal, that doesn't prove that you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do what we can't do, but he could do. That doesn't prove it. Because it could be the reason why this is prohibited is because he can't do it. Not because I can't do it, but because he can't do it. And this is left in the Gemara as inconclusive. Meaning, we know for a fact that we're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to neuter our animals. Can't do it. But it's inconclusive why. Is the reason because I can't do it, but he could. But I can't do it, so I can't ask him to do what I can't do. Is that the reason? Or is the reason because he can't do it, and I'm not allowed to have someone do what he can't do, because then I'm enabling an avera, so I can't do that. Those are the 2 possibilities. Is it because I can't, or because he can't? Those are the 2 sides of the Gemara. Now this is critical because this will affect any attempt we make to try to permit it. We have to deal with 2 possibilities why it's prohibited. If you don't know why it's prohibited, then you can't deal with ways of getting around the prohibition. You got to know what the problem is in order to try to fix the problem. And there's 2 possible problems over here. Now let's begin with a case that will be a nafka mina, that will be a difference between these 2 reasons. I shared this with the group I was studying with. Let's begin with a case where, depending which reason you say, this case will either be permitted or prohibited. Listen carefully to the case. Until now, the Gemara is talking about a case where I have an animal that I need to neutered. So I'm going to arrange a situation for the non-Jew to do it for me. Prohibited. Not allowed. But what about the following case? I raise animals. I breed animals. That's what I do for a living. And I have customers who buy these animals. One of my major customers is a company that buys the animals, neuters them, and then sells them to people who want to buy neutered animals. Not sells them back to me. Sells them to whoever needs them. Whether it's a farmer who needs a neutered animal, whether it's a pet owner, a person who wants to be a pet owner, who wants a neutered animal, whatever it is. But their job, their business is to neuter animals. And they buy from me. They are, I'm their supplier. I raise animals. They buy the animals from me, neuter them, and then sell them off. Now, is that permitted for me to do? Can I be in a business that sells animals? Can I be a supplier for a company, a non-Jewish owned company, that their job is to neuter animals? Now, it depends which reason you use over here. If the reason why I can't have a non-Jew neuter my animal for me is because he's not allowed to do it, if that's the reason, well then I can't be a supplier for a non-Jewish company that's going to neuter animals, because I am therefore enabling them to do what they can't do. They're not allowed to do it. They may not know they're not allowed to do it, but they're not allowed to. And I, knowing the truth, I'm not allowed to give them the animals to neuter. How could I do that? That would be like selling idols to someone who's going to worship idols. Can't do that. So how can I sell animals to someone who's going to neuter them? Can't do it. That's if the reason is because he can't do it. But if the reason why I can't have the non-Jew neuter my animal is not because he can't do it. He could do whatever he wants. It's because I can't ask him to do what I can't do. Because I can't do it. That's the reason. Well, in this case, I'm not asking him to do anything. I'm selling animals. He has his own business. His business is he neuters animals and sells them to somebody else. That has nothing to do with me. That's his decision, what he wants to do with animals that he buys. Has nothing to do with the supplier. I don't care if he neuters the animal or if he takes the animals and puts them in the circus. I mean, it makes no difference to me. So if the reason is because I can't do it, then in this case, it's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with being a supplier of animals to a company that neuters animals and sells them off. Because they're not doing it for me. They're doing it for themselves, for their own business. And that would be perfectly fine. So the two reasons makes a difference. And in Shulchan Aruch, this case is mentioned. Are you allowed to sell animals to someone, to a non-Jew, who is definitely going to neuter the animal? Not for you, but for themselves, for their own business, whatever it is. They're doing it for their own reasons. Are you allowed to be a supplier for that non-Jew? And the Shulchan Aruch says, it depends which of these reasons you use. If you say that the reason is because the non-Jew cannot do it, well, then you can't do this either. But if the reason is because the Jew can't do it, in this case, it's perfectly fine. That's what we have in Shulchan Aruch. So we still haven't found any loophole for a situation where I have a pet that I want neutered for me. That we haven't found any loophole for. But these two reasons will make a difference in the case of the suppliers. So let's pause here. Any questions on the two reasons and the case that makes a difference with these two reasons?
Well, the Shulchan Aruch then basically refuses to rule on this case.
Well, the Shulchan Aruch says that the main opinion is that non-Jews are permitted. They're not prohibited. That's the main opinion. The main opinion is that it's not one of the seven Noahide laws. And therefore, the main opinion would be that I could be a supplier. But then there is a Yesh Omrim, there are those who say that no, you can't do it.
Majority rules. Typically.
Well, when you say majority rules, it depends. The Shulchan Aruch brings both opinions. But yeah, the main opinion would be that it's permitted. That is the main opinion. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. So, what about our case? Now, we do have a loophole in selling things to non-Jews. We know that we do this. For instance, with Pesach, we sell chametz to the non-Jew. We do it every single year. There are other cases in which the sale to a non-Jew is the only way things can be done. Let me give you two other examples besides this case. Two other examples. One is, what if I have a fruit-bearing tree on my property? I don't want the fruit-bearing tree there. Now there's a prohibition in the Torah, lo tashchis es eitzah, you're not allowed to cut down a fruit tree. Not only that, but it gets everybody scared because in the Gemara it says there's a curse against someone who cuts down a fruit tree. So no one wants to go there. Everybody's very nervous about cutting down a fruit tree. Now there are cases where it's permitted. There are cases where it's permitted in a case where a person is going to build a building, build a house, and there's a fruit tree in the way, and the value of the building will be clearly more than the value of the fruit tree. There are cases where it's permitted. But everybody's very nervous because of this curse. No one wants to get involved with that. Therefore, in that case, what is recommended is to sell it to a non-Jew. Because the prohibition against cutting down a fruit tree is clearly only a prohibition on Jews. Doesn't say it about non-Jews. No one says that's one of the seven laws. So sell it to a non-Jew and you avoid the problem. That's one case of sale to a non-Jew. Another case of sale to a non-Jew is, you know that today we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, of course, unfortunately. So we don't have a temple. Therefore, if someone would have an animal that they would sanctify it and say, this animal is now going to be a sacrifice. I declare this animal will be an Ola sacrifice. Person would do that. It's a very, very poorly planned thing to do. One should not do that. If one would do it, what do we do with this animal? What would you do with an animal if someone said, I declare this animal is now a carbon, this animal is sanctified as a sacrifice? What do you do with it? You know what the answer is? Absolutely nothing. You just have to let the animal live till it dies. You're stuck with it. You're stuck with it. You can't work the animal. It's sanctified. If it bears milk, you can't drink it. You can't do anything with it. This animal is off limits. So today, where there's no temple, you don't want to do that. Don't make any animals into sacrifices. But there is one type of animal that's automatically a sacrifice. You have no choice. It happens by itself. What animal is that? A bechor. A firstborn, a petarechem, a firstborn animal from a domesticated kosher animal. That means from a cow, a sheep, or a goat. A firstborn is automatically a sacrifice if it's male. And you can't do anything with it, which is pretty debilitating. They grow up, they become aggressive, and you can't do anything with it. In this case, once it gets a blemish, it could be slaughtered. This is a different type of sacrifice than other ones. Once it gets a blemish, it could be slaughtered. But you can't put the blemish in. It has to happen by itself. So it's very difficult to own one of these animals these days. Well, we can't do anything with it until it develops some sort of blemish. Therefore, the way around the problem is that when you have a cow, a sheep, or a goat that is about to have its first child, what do? Sell it. Or sell part of it to a non-Jew. And that way, when it births, that animal is not born from an animal that was owned only by a Jew. And therefore, it will not have the law of Bechor. It will not be a sanctified animal. So there, again, it's almost legislated that that's what you should do. Just like we sell the chametz, and just like with the fruit tree, you can sell the fruit tree. Here, you sell the animal to the non-Jew, and as a result, you end up without a problem. But tell me, what is the difference between the chametz case, the fruit tree case, the Bechor case, and this case of neutering the animal? Why is this one more difficult to deal with?
Because you're getting it back.
Well, I heard because you're getting it back. What else?
The non-Jews allowed to eat chametz.
Okay, the non-Jews allowed to eat chametz. Is the non-Jew allowed to cut down a fruit tree?
Yes.
Is the non-Jew able to own an animal that will then have a firstborn?
Yes.
Is a non-Jew allowed to neuter an animal?
We're not sure.
So you see, this is more complicated. Because over here, you've got a prohibition that might apply to him also. And the other ones, what's wrong with a non-Jew owning chametz on Pesach? Absolutely nothing. What's wrong with a non-Jew owning a fruit tree and then cutting it down? Nothing. What's wrong with a non-Jew owning an animal? There's no prohibition at all over there. Just the animal's going to be bored and not be sanctified. What's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing. But here, we've got more of an issue. Because this might be a prohibition for him too. not just for me. So we've got bigger problems here than with the other cases. Now, we have a loophole. We do have a loophole. The loophole will help us with both problems, both the question of asking a non-Jew to do what I can't do, and also the loophole, and also the problem of asking a Jew to do, a non-Jew to do what he can't do. We do have a loophole. Now, I have to caution you that this loophole is not as simple as it sounds, as you'll hear as we move along in the shir. But we have to start with this loophole. What happens if, let's take Shabbos. So I'm not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. Can't do that. Not allowed to light a fire. Let's say I need the fire on. The stovetop went out. My chalent got unplugged. I had a crock pot. It got unplugged. I need to be plugged back in. So I can't ask a non-Jew to do it either. I can't do it, and I can't ask him to plug it in either. Could I ask a non-Jew to ask another non-Jew to plug in the crock pot? Amira de Amira. Could I ask one to ask another? Rabbi Golding is laughing because he has a great story about this, which I'll let him tell sometime. But could I ask one non-Jew, some of you may have heard the story, could I ask one non-Jew to ask another non-Jew to do what I cannot do? Now you understand that maybe this is okay because it's two steps removed. Even though I'm not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do what I can't do, but perhaps if I ask him to ask someone else, so it's two steps removed, that's far enough away from me that it's okay. So this is debated. The Chavos Yair is the one who goes through this back and forth, and as a result, since he doesn't come out conclusively that it's okay, but because it is a question, might be okay, might not be okay, therefore in a situation of great need, or a situation where there is doubt in the first place, whether there's a problem, where it may not be a big deal anyway, like let's say it's something which we're not sure is prohibited. In that sort of situation, we do rely on this Chavos Yair. You have to ask your LOR, your local Orthodox rabbi, to find out whether we will apply the ruling of the Chavos Yair in a particular instance or not. You can't just use it, you know, carte blanche. But there are situations where we will permit asking one non-Jew to ask another non-Jew. Now you understand when you do this, the first non-Jew is going to look at you with a, like, what are you talking about? And the second non-Jew will almost certainly say, well, what are you talking about? As in Rabbi Golding's famous case where the second non-Jew said to the first non-Jew, listen, if the Jew wants me to do it, why doesn't he ask me himself? So you got to deal with that. But at any rate, you may be able to rely on this under certain circumstances. Interestingly, the same loophole could also help if he can't do it. Because the whole problem, if he can't do it, is b'lifnei iver, is don't put a stumbling block in front of someone who can't do something. So as I said, I can't take a cup of wine and hand it to a nazir, even though I'm not telling him to drink it, but I am enabling him to do something which he cannot do. However, there is a concept of lifnei de lifnei, which means I'm putting the stumbling block before the blind person, which means two steps removed from the blind person. I'm not handing him the wine directly. I'm giving the wine to another person who then gives the wine to the nazir. The nazir still can't drink the wine, but I'm not implicated in the avera because I'm two steps removed from the nazir. There is a loophole like that as well. And therefore, a way around this problem, at least for the Jew, a way around this problem would be to give it, the animal, to one non-Jew, and then having him give the animal to another non-Jew to have the animal neutered. Two steps removed. But you initiated. So in terms of the letter of the law, it would not be a prohibition for you to do that. I'm not telling you it's a good thing to do, but if you're asking, is it permitted, you are not implicated because you're two steps removed. Right? We're dealing here with, we got to deal with two things over here. You're dealing with, does it feel good? It may not feel good, But are we dealing with the letter of the law? Are you implicated? The answer is no. You're two steps removed from the prohibition. So the two steps removed could help us in both these issues. The one issue of asking a non-Jew to do what I can't do, it might help for that. And then also for asking the non-Jew to do what he can't do, same thing. The two steps removed might help me. Now over here, just to deal with what Elliot is bothered by over here, we can toggle back and forth between the two reasons. We don't know which reason is really true. And remember, the main opinion is that a non-Jew is allowed to neuter an animal. That's the main opinion. And therefore, the main opinion is the reason why I can't ask him to do it is because I can't do it, and therefore I can't ask him to do it. But in the two steps removed, that could be okay. Step to the other side of the fence, what if really he can't do it either? Again, the two steps removed could be okay. If you're dealing with the moral question of, yeah, but I am ultimately having him do something which he can't do, you'll have to say, well, maybe the other reason is really true, that he could do it. That's the only way to justify it. But if you really want to cover, if you really are nervous about this moral issue, then you shouldn't do it this way either. Because it is a possibility that he is doing something which he can't do and you ultimately initiated it. But according to the letter of the law, the two steps removed would permit both the issues at hand. Let's pause here for questions. And then we're going to move to chametz. Yeah.
Two steps away apply to murder?
Nope, it does not apply to murder. Because there, it doesn't apply to murder because there we know for a fact that he can't do it. And anyway, with murder, you're dealing with a societal issue over there. There's also, you're dealing with something which is prohibited here as well in the United States. Neutering an animal, there's no, you're not dealing with a legal issue in the United States. Right?
In the original case of Morris, if the animal had actually been stolen, gone through this trick stealing mechanism, and then it was actually found that it was neutered, can you benefit from it?
No. No. I mean, that's what Morris says. He has to get rid of the animal.
Yeah, but it said because he tricked, it gave a reason relating to the tricky mechanism.
Yeah.
So that would suggest, wouldn't it, that if it wasn't for this tricky mechanism.
Okay, so you're, I see what you're saying. Okay. Dr. Sloan's question is that what if it wasn't the tricky thing? What if, in the case of the Gemara, the animal really was stolen? I didn't understand the question when you asked it. Let's say it really was stolen. Not that, you know, wink, 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 it was stolen, but it actually was stolen. And then when I got my animal back, it was neutered. So then could I benefit from it? The answer is yes, you could in that case. Because I didn't ask him to do it. I didn't ask him to do it for me. The Gemara only penalizes the person when I enabled it. But if he did it without, you know, it wasn't something which I asked him to do and he did it for his own business or whatever, or maybe he was trying to hurt me. Like he thought I didn't want it neutered. He thought I was breeding animals. And the truth is, I really wanted to plow with it. And so he ended up helping me when he tried to hurt me. I could benefit from that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The way the process of working out an agreement is that the secretary is there, the nurse takes the dog back.
Okay, so
there's already a three step removed from entering the office.
Good. Okay, so here's the issue. There was a member of this community who went to a vet to ask about having their pet neutered. And they came in and they expressed their religious concern with neutering an animal. So the receptionist said, oh, that's no problem. We do this all the time. People come in, they sell the animal to me, the receptionist, and then I have the animal neutered by the doctor, by the vet, and then we sell the animal back to you. So that actually happened here. And what we have to discuss is whether that's acceptable or not. It seems, from what we just said, that should be okay because it's a two-step process. The person who's taking the animal from me is not the one who's going to do the neutering. Now, the way you described it, which is that there's no sale involved, where I give it to the first person, he gives it to the next person, gives it to the next person, and then they neuter it. It's hard to justify that because ultimately I'm the one who is asking that be done. It's not that I give it to the receptionist and then the receptionist comes and says to the vet, would you do me a favor and neuter the animal? That's how it's happening. Right? It's all for me directly, even though it goes through a few different hands. But in the case of selling it, if I actually sell the animal to the receptionist, then the receptionist has it done, wink, 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 meaning the receptionist is doing, it's not the Jew's animal anymore, it belongs to the receptionist. And they're having it done. And then they're selling it back to me. That would seem to be an application of this two-step process to have it done. Okay, so in order to see whether that's okay or not, we need to move into chuppah. Let's see if there are any other questions on this issue.
Here.
Yeah.
The case of neutering the animal, is that not somewhat comparable to sale of land and material and their soil to a non-Jew?
That's a good question. You're asking about Shemitah. Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to go there because Shemitah is rife with all kinds of other issues. I recognize that that is another case that we could talk about, but I'm deliberately avoiding that one. Maybe when we get to a Shemitah year, which is coming up, we'll have a share on that exclusively. No promises.
So can we conclude that it's permitted for that lip neiver only applies to Jews?
I mean, is there at least an neiver for a non-Jew to enable a non-Jew to do a prohibition?
One thing is, I mean, you said the two-step process would not work if it's perfect.
Yeah, okay, I got it. I got it. Yeah, so Jeff is asking the following question, which is a little bit involved. But Jeff is asking that when I give the animal to the first non-Jew, who is then going to give it to the second non-Jew, so I may not be enabling the Avera of neutering, but I'm enabling the Avera of causing someone else to do an Avera, of Lifnei Iver. Because he's going to, right. So that's a good question. Most authorities say that there is no prohibition of Lifnei Iver on a non-Jew. The Minchas Chinuch does discuss it. But I believe that most authorities say that there is no prohibition for Lifnei Iver. Good question. Okay. So, why do we need to discuss Chametz? So listen carefully how Chametz works. Chametz, every Pesach gets sold. Now we all know that we're going to sell our Chametz, and after we sell it, the chametz is going to stay there in our pantry. Of course, it's going to be blocked off. You know, either the cabinet is going to be closed off, or there'll be something up in front of the chametz, like a cardboard or something, that it's blocked off and clearly marked chametz off limits. I'm not going to touch it over Pesach. And we know that over Pesach, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to the non-Jew. I've got 12 boxes of Cheerios, and it's all, you know, it's blocked off somewhere in my house. And it says on there, big letters, Chametz, stay away, danger, you know, skull and crawl, whatever. So, that's what it says. So, and I know that over Pesach, legally, I don't own it. It's owned by the non-Jew. And then, magically, about an hour after Pesach, the rabbi says, you can, now it becomes yours again. And then, I finish cleaning up from Pesach, put everything away, and I sit down to a bowl of Cheerios. Beautiful. So I had a bowl of Cheerios Erev Pesach, before I burned my chametz, I had a bowl of Cheerios, then I put it all away, and then, after Pesach, about an hour after Pesach, I sit down to a bowl of Cheerios. It's a beautiful system. It's wonderful. So, it doesn't feel so good, because, like, it feels a little funny. I mean, who are we kidding? Where's that? The chametz was in my pantry the whole time, it never left. Okay, so I put up a big sign, don't touch it. But, I mean, it's there the whole time, I had a bowl before, I had a bowl, how is this working? And we all do it. So how do we rely on such a thing? So the way it works, first of all, you should know from the legal side of things, the rabbis, when they sell the chametz, they invoke many types of sales. You know that to have a kinyan happen, a transaction happen, there are all kinds of kinyanim of transactions that are discussed in the Gemara. There is kinyan kesef. I give you money. By giving you money, the object I want to purchase becomes mine. That's one method. There's kinyan hagba'ah. Hagba'ah is to lift up something. When I lift it up, it becomes mine. There's kinyan meshicha. I want it to become mine. I pull it, it becomes mine. There is kinyan agav. Agav is a little bit more complicated. Agav is that I want to acquire from you land and a car. So I purchase the land, and along with the land comes the car. We don't have to get into the details of that, but that's another type of kinyan, another type of acquisition. There is an acquisition called chatzer. Chatzer means that I have a domain, my front yard. and you take an item and you put it down in my front yard and it becomes mine magically because it's in my domain. So it becomes mine. That's another type of kinyan, another type of acquisition. There are many types of acquisitions. It's not clear which types of acquisitions work with non-Jews and which don't. It's unclear. With Jews, there's a lot of legislation out there, and we know what works and what doesn't work. In which instances this one works, which instances that one works, and we have it all over the Gemara. But with non-Jews, although it is discussed in the Gemara quite extensively, it's not clear which types of acquisitions work and which don't. Therefore, when rabbis sell the chametz, they use usually six different types of kinyanim, of acquisitions. It's not this, you know, we're done in a second kind of thing. The non-Jew, the one that I attended in Baltimore, when I watched the chametz being sold, the non-Jew was, it was a lengthy process in which the rabbi explained everything. The non-Jew had done it many times before, but still the rabbi explained everything to him, and it was discussed, and they made all kinds of legally binding agreements with documents and everything, etc. But the bottom line is, after all those acquisitions are said and done, what happens is, they evaluate the chametz. So let's say the chametz comes out to be $100,000. Chametz of everybody in the community, it's $100,000. So the non-Jew agrees to purchase all the chametz for $100,000. Now, he doesn't have $100,000 in cash. Most people don't. So the non-Jew takes out a $10 bill and he pays the rabbi a down payment of $10 with a loan of $99,990. That the remaining amount of money he owes 2 weeks later. He pays $10 now, and he owes $99,990. And he'll pay it in 2 weeks. In the event that the rabbi doesn't buy it back from him, then he will owe the rabbi $99,990. After Pesach is over, before the non-Jew has to pay the rest of the money, the rabbi comes to the non-Jew and says, listen, I know you bought the chametz for $100,000 and you still owe me $99,990. But you know what? I'd like to buy the chametz back. And I'll buy it back from you for $100,050. So the non-Jew says, well, I don't really have the $99,990 to pay with, so I accept your purchase for $100,050. So the rabbi says, okay, I will pay you $100,050. Now you owe me $99,990. So $100,050 minus $99,990 is $60. So the rabbi takes out $60, hands it to the non-Jew, and we're done. And now the rabbi has purchased back all of the chametz, and everybody can eat their chametz again. That's the way it works. But the acquisition is done in many ways. There's a document, and there's a sale, and there's a lending of the property, and there is giving of, there's all kinds of different, there's a handshake, there's all kinds of things that go on in the actual process. So the Chassam Sofer was asked the following question. The Chassam Sofer was asked, I don't understand, but we all know it's a joke. He doesn't have any intention of purchasing. So what do you mean? The non-Jew knows it's all going to be, in the end he's going to make $50 on the deal. That, he knows that. He's done it every year for the past 30 years. So who are you kidding? He doesn't have in mind to acquire. And you know, in order for an acquisition to work, the seller has to have in mind to sell, and the purchaser has to have in mind to purchase. If the non-Jew is just doing this as some kind of a ritual, then what kind of purchase is there over here? So the Chassam Sofer says, and this is critical, the Chassam Sofer says, with the sale of chametz, it's not such a big deal. Even if the non-Jew didn't have in mind to purchase, he thought it was just a ritual, and he didn't have in mind. So the Chassam Sofer says, first of all, it doesn't really matter, because this is a legally binding sale. We could take him to court on this sale. Every document is legally binding. So, even if he doesn't have in mind, I mean, try that in a court of law. You go to court, and you've got all these documents, and you say, well, I didn't mean it. What do you mean you didn't mean it? You signed it. I mean, it's all, there are witnesses, everything. So, it's legally binding. So that's first of all. But the Chassam Sofer also says that when it comes to chametz, what's the main goal of selling the chametz? Is the main goal that the non-Jew should own the chametz? Or is the main goal that we Jews should not own the chametz?
I think we Jews should not own
it. We Jews should not own the chametz. The main goal over here is not that he should get it, it's that we shouldn't have it. In fact, if we would make it hefker, if we would make it ownerless, we would just get up in front of everybody and say, all the chametz I own is hefker. Anybody can take it if they wish. That would also work. In fact, we do that. We say bir chametz. We say I am being mevatel, a bittul chametz, I am being mevatel all of my chametz. I make it null and void. Anybody can take the chametz if they wish. We do that. The reason why we do the sale is because if I've got the Cheerios sitting in my pantry and I go out and I say, anybody wants to take the Cheerios? Well, I don't see anybody coming. Who's going to come into my pantry to take the Cheerios? So we don't rely only on just saying anybody can take it. But if I do a sale also, then as long as we go through the process of a sale, and as long as everybody who is selling the chametz is convinced that we have a legally binding sale, which we do, the fact that the non-Jew doesn't really believe he's buying it is irrelevant, says the Chasam Sofer. Because the fact of the matter is, we're all getting rid of our chametz. And that's fine. And as long as we're getting rid of our chametz in a real way, we feel we are getting rid of it, we mean it when we say it's not ours, then we're okay for Pesach. Because that's really all that matters. You don't have to have a buyer. You got to get rid of it. We have a buyer to ensure that we're really getting rid of it. That's what chametz. Now, with chametz, if I get rid of my chametz and someone actually comes and takes it, that's what it means to get rid of your chametz. When you sell your chametz and when you make your chametz null and void, you are opening yourself up to someone coming and taking it. And you can't stop them. Let's say the non-Jew would walk into your house on Pesach and say, I'd like a box of Cheerios. Are you able to stop him? You can't stop him. It's his Cheerios. It belongs to him.
It's his pantry.
Well, that shelf in the pantry anyway, it's his pantry, yes. So if he says, I want that box of Cheerios, you got to give him access. You got to let him in and let him take the box of Cheerios. It's his. It belongs to him. When it comes to these other cases, let's say neutering the animal, what's the goal over here? Is the goal for me to not own the pet, or is the goal for the non-Jew to own the pet? Which is what we want over here? Okay, so for me to not own it, right? Because I'm the one who's prohibited. But the problem is, will I be okay if I make that pet null and void and someone else comes and takes it? Is that okay with me? No. I'm not interested in someone else taking my pet. That's not what I'm doing over here. I don't want that pet going anywhere else. I want that pet returned to me. This is not a situation where I'm trying to get rid of something. This is a situation where I want that pet to go to the non-Jew where he's legally bound to return it to me with money. You know, there's a purchase and a sale, etc. And I just want something to happen in the interim, which I can't do myself. So with the pet, it's a little bit more complicated because the goal over here is not simply that I shouldn't have it, even though you're right. From the halacha's perspective, that would work. If I don't own it, then I'm not doing anything. But I'm not interested in not owning it because non-ownership means someone else may take it. Non-ownership means someone else could walk off with it. That's what it means with the chametz. Here, I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in non-ownership. I'm interested in selling it to the vet so the vet will take care of it and then he'll give it back to me. Because of this distinction, the Maram Shik writes that although you can do this, we'll call it shtick, of selling it and then, you know, having them do it to someone else, you know, they'll give it to another non-Jew, he writes, you should not do this in a way where the non-Jews are aware that this is some sort of a ritual, like the sale of chametz. With the sale of chametz, it's okay that they think it's a ritual. But over here, if they believe it's a ritual, and they're not actually having in mind to purchase, it's just some kind of a joke, some kind of this, you know, like blessing the food, you know, it's like that kind of thing. Where they think, well, the Jew can't do it, we have to go through this ritual, and they don't really have in mind to purchase, The Maharam Sheikh writes, you should not rely on that. If you're going to do this, you need to do it in a way where the non-Jew really does believe there is a sale going on over here, that it actually belongs to him, and he's taking care of it. In the situation here in this community where someone had to have it done, what I told the person was, rather than go through that vet, where the person said, remember the receptionist said, oh, we do this all the time, just sell it to me, and then I'll give it to the vet. That's a joke. They don't really have in mind to purchase. So I told the person in the community they should sell it to their non-Jewish acquaintance. They had a friend who was a non-Jew. Sell it to that non-Jewish person. Actually sell them the animal. Let them go to the vet by themselves. Nothing to do with you. Go through the regular process of having it neutered, the way anybody would go have it neutered. And then he'll sell it back to you. Because there, it doesn't appear to be just a ritual. It's not something they do all the time. See, the ritual problem is when it's done every year, when it's done all the time. Then the non-Jew will get it into their head that this is just something Jews do. It's not a real thing. That's a problem when it comes to neutering a pet. When it comes to chametz, that's okay. But when it comes to neutering a pet, that's a problem. And therefore, it should be a real sale. Sell it to a non-Jew, let them do what they have to do to take care of it, and then sell it back to you. That would be the way, if there is a loophole to have it done, that's the way to have it done. You, of course, you're much better off purchasing a pet that already is neutered, so you don't have to get into all of this. But if you have a pet that needs to be neutered, this would be the preferred method of doing it. Similarly, with the cutting out of a fruit tree, which some of this community also needed to deal with recently, it would be a similar thing, that you can sell it, but it shouldn't just be a ritual. You should sell it to a non-Jew, for real, and then let them, if they want to cut down the tree, they can cut down the tree, whatever they want to do with it, and then you can purchase back, if it's the property, if whatever, however you're going to work out the sale and the purchase, I'm not sure how it works, of land, because the fruit tree is on a piece of property, not sure exactly how that works. But in that situation, you're going to want to make it a real sale. Unlike the sale of chametz, where the ritual process is okay, in these cases, you're going to want to make it a real sale. We are a little bit over time, but I am willing to take a question or two. Yeah?
In the practical case of selling it to your acquaintance, how do you convey it where it doesn't have that air of...
Yeah, it's a good point. You're pointing out that even in a one-time sale, it could appear to be a ritual, except that when it's a one-time sale, so then you say it exactly like it is. I need to sell it to you. And a sale means a sale. It only becomes more like a ritual when it's done all the time. When this person's been involved in it a dozen times, so he's like, oh yeah, you know, yawn, you know, fine. And it becomes like a joke. Yeah?
What about with me during that
case? It's got to be where it's the second non-Jew. First non-Jew to the second non-Jew. He'll take it to the vet, and the vet, well, he's not going to do it himself. He's not going to do it himself. That would take care of that. If the non-Jew is not allowed to do it, it would take care of that problem to make it a two-step removed process. Yeah?
What about in the case of certain cats,
for example,
Siamese cats that have a higher particular lymphoma? They have a higher particular lymphoma. So I have a Siamese cat, and our vet told us that this cat was already developing stuff, you have to do with your cat's health.
Okay, so you're asking for a different reason. Let's take the health issue for the pet, for the animal. The animal will die if it is not fixed in that way. That's a way of, it's no different than any other amputation. Right. So there's plenty of room to be lenient in that kind of situation. Because there you're not doing it, you're doing it to preserve the life of the animal. You should ask a shiloh anyway in those situations, but there's much more room to be lenient in those cases. Just like with a human being. Yeah.
We made a distinction between chametz and a neutering, saying that, you know, the chametz, you know, I want to make it ownerless, and, you know, somebody would come to my house and actually take it, it's not a big deal, but with my pet, certainly not the case, I don't want to sell it, someone else is going to keep it. What would be the situation with the chametz if I'm a store owner, and I'm not just selling $100 worth of chametz, that I don't really care, I have to buy materials, I have to buy principles, but I've got thousands and thousands of dollars worth of merchandise that I really don't want anyone to come in.
Yeah.
Like maybe there might be somebody who owns like a liquor store or something like that, and his choice is either giving it out to Jews free or pay stuff, or...
This is a theoretical question, right?
And I'm not getting a job.
Well, no, but you can be
paying a fair price for it. That's, I mean, if you're a stoner, maybe you don't mind if someone comes in and takes it all and gives you a fair price.
It's a good question. It's a good question in that situation, how whether it should be done in a more of a binding type of way. It's a good question. That's a good question. The discussion in the Chuvas, in the Responsa, is about a person who has an animal that they want to be mefatim, to fatten the animal. And the way they did it was with chametz feed. And they would sell the animal to a non-Jew over Pesach, and the non-Jew would continue to feed the animal, to fatten the animal. So there, it's not just getting rid of the chametz. You actually want the chametz and the animal to interact over Pesach. That's what you want over there. So there they deal with it much more seriously, because they're not just trying to get rid of everything. You actually want a process to happen. And therefore it's dealt with much more seriously, that the sale has to be much more seriously binding than in the regular type of sale of chametz. So you're asking, in a store owner situation, what's the case? But I mean, there's so many Jewish store owners, there must be a bunch of press on this as well. I don't know if they do it any differently than they would do a regular sale. But it's a good question.
When did this idea of selling the chametz pass on? When did we see the first
mention of
that?
You see it all the way back in the Rishonim already, in the time of the Ritva writes about it. We're talking in the 13th century. You already see it. It's already there. It was probably done before then too, but you already find it in writing back then. The Gemara doesn't discuss this, not in that way, not in a universal way. It discusses what happens if a non-Jew owns chametz on your property. What if you sell chametz to a non-Jew? The what ifs are discussed, but not as something which should regularly be done.
That's
Rishonim.
Yeah.
I read someplace that Jews in Europe, kind of the whiskey business, the beer business, have used stocks.
Yeah, that's
part of the way to do something.
Yeah, the whiskey business is how it really became something that was done universally. That's really where it became a big deal. Because, like, you know, people had huge storehouses, and what do you do with that? Right. That's right. Yeah, just drink it. Right. Okay, everybody say a chag kosher v'sameach. Happy and kosher Pesach. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.